From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Claire Wiley. This morning, first, we are going to be going deep into the sea with National Geographic explorer Dr. Lisa Briggs. Dr. Briggs is an underwater archaeologist and an archaeological scientist and documentary filmmaker. She is best known for her work excavating shipwrecks and conducting scientific analysis on artifacts recovered from some of the world's most important underwater archaeological sites, including Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge. In fact, she is on a tour with National Geographic Live about pirates, and she was just in our community on Friday talking about that, and we had such a great conversation as well. Then we are going to go back to a great conversation with biologist and author Karen Lloyd, who breaks down her firsthand account of the hunt for life beneath Earth's surface. Her book, Intraterrestrial, shares what scientists are learning about strange types of microbial life and how research expeditions to some of the most extreme locales on the planet are broadening our understanding of what life is and how its earliest forms may have evolved. So a great conversation coming up for you on This Green Earth right now, Tuesdays in the 9 a.m. hour. Thanks for tuning in. We will speak with Dr. Briggs in just a moment. And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and now we have the pleasure of speaking with National Geographic explorer Dr. Lisa Briggs. Dr. Briggs is an underwater archaeologist, archaeological scientist, and documentary filmmaker. She's best known for her work excavating shipwrecks and conducting scientific analysis on artifacts recovered from some of the world's most important underwater archaeological sites, including Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge. Welcome, Dr. Lisa Briggs.
Thank you, Claire. I'm so delighted to be here to speak with you today.
Well, we are thrilled to have you here on This Green Earth. As I was chatting with people in our office about you coming on the show, everyone has a question because this is such a thrilling line of work. So I'm going to start first. I know that you dig into the very deep, deep past, but we're going to dig a little bit into a closer past, into your origin story, into archaeology, and specifically the areas in which you work now.
Sure, absolutely. So it's probably controversial to say now, but I definitely got into archaeology generally because of Indiana Jones. And that film made a very big impression on me as a child. I went on to study archaeology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And there I found out that archaeology involves a lot more paperwork and a lot less whipcraft and being afraid of snakes than Indiana Jones had led me to believe. But I loved it nonetheless. And I've always been fascinated by the ancient world and the underwater world. I did come to underwater archaeology through different means, though, that on my first ever scuba dive in the Red Sea in Egypt, I saw a series of these big Roman pots that we call amphora lying there on the seafloor. And in the Red Sea in Egypt, they were covered in coral and they had tropical fish swimming in and out of them. And I just was immediately smitten with not just the archaeology of it, but the underwater world and the intersection between the marine biology you find in marine environments and the archaeology. So that's definitely how I came to be an underwater archaeologist.
Well, that's where a lot of our fascination lies here on This Green Earth, is how the natural world comes into play with these sites. But first, let's talk a little bit about this process of excavation, what it entails, and how you even begin this process. And I think a lot of people have questions about how you know it's Blackbeard's flagship and how you derive that information.
Sure. Well, I can start by describing the process of how we discover shipwrecks. A lot of shipwrecks are actually found by accident. A lot of wrecks are found by fishermen fishing near and about them. And the reason for that is because fish love a shipwreck. Shipwrecks create an artificial reef on the seafloor, and that gives fish, especially juvenile fish, the opportunity to grow up in a safe environment where there's all these little nooks and crannies created by the artifacts on the seafloor where they can hide from predators. It also, because it creates this artificial reef, it creates the opportunity for fish to lay their eggs there. So hence why we see so many juvenile fish. And it's basically like a fish nursery where they're breeding and growing. So you'll often have these big schools of fish that hang out around the shipwreck because that's where they're born. And then that's also why bigger predator fish come there, because they might want to snatch up and munch on a little juvenile fish who grew up there. So fishermen have found a lot of these shipwreck sites just because that's where the fish are, and that's the most fertile hunting fishing ground. In addition, though, and in particular, Blackbeard's shipwreck, that was found by a company that was actually looking for another ship. It was found by a company called Intersal in the 1990s, and they were using a big underwater metal detector that we call a magnetometer to scan the seafloor for big hunks of metal. Now, these magnetometers, they mostly work on ferrous metals, things that have iron in them. And when they got a signal on the seafloor, there was a big lump of metal there, they sent divers down to inspect it. But because they knew that the ship, the El Salvador, that they were looking for, it only had like 4 cannons on it. And on their first ever dive on this site, they immediately saw many more than 4 cannons. I think they saw like 10 or 12 cannons on their first dive. They knew it had to be a different ship than the El Salvador. And so that's how the Queen Anne's Revenge was first discovered.
So how did you become a part of that project, and what did you learn from it?
Oh, goodness, I have learned so much from it. But how I first became involved is I was working on a much smaller shipwreck in the Caribbean on the island of Tortola in a place called Roadtown Harbor, which, related to the talk that I give for National Geographic, it was very much like a kind of pirate bay. Roadtown Harbor had a lot of pirate activity. And this little tiny ship I was excavating there, we call the pipe wreck because a lot of clay pipes were found on it. We even found musket balls embedded in the hull of the boat, meaning that was probably fired upon maybe by pirates. But while working down there, I met one of the underwater archaeologists who works on the Queen Anne's Revenge site. And, you know, I guess he saw that I was a really hard worker and was really enthusiastic about working hard. So immediately after I graduated from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, I was given a job on the Queen Anne's Revenge. So actually, it was my first job out of college.
Oh, wow.
Was to excavate this pirate ship.
So when you're starting to extract this, what is that process, and what were some of the things that you pulled up from that particular shipwreck?
So from Blackbeard's wreck, the process is very similar to other ones. And I do have to say that the team on the Queen Anne's Revenge, they have such a high level of excavation. It's really incredible. We are absolutely meticulous in recovering tiny, tiny artifacts and recording absolutely everything. But to give you an overview of how we first dive into these shipwrecks and understand them, first we would do what we would call a non-invasive survey. So that would involve recording all of the things that we can see on the seafloor just by swimming over them and measuring the distance from what we call a baseline, which is kind of just an arbitrary line that we peg down on the site, but then we measure everything off of that line to know exactly where it is. And then we draw this big, beautiful, comprehensive map of the site, and that shows you where all the artifacts are in relation to one another. And that is really important for figuring out what side of the ship is the bow and what side of the ship might be the stern, and the contextual information about how the artifacts relate to each other. So that is all non-invasive, and we normally start that just by divers going down on the survey. Once we have a really good idea about the state of the shipwreck in kind of its natural state before anyone has started digging into it, only then do we begin the process of underwater excavation. Now, underwater excavation is a lot like digging a site on land, except for, as opposed to using a trowel, which is like, you know, a little handheld metal scoopy thing that we dig under the dirt with, underwater we use what we call a dredge, which is basically like a big underwater vacuum cleaner. And the dredge slowly picks up the seafloor sediment and the sand. And one thing that's really great that we do on the Queen Anne's Revenge site is we suck up all that sand and seafloor sediment, but it actually goes up to the deck of our research vessel where we collect all of it. And then we go through all of that in case there's any little artifacts that we missed while we were digging underwater. While we're digging underwater, though, we can always see the really big artifacts. We can see the cannonballs and the musket balls, pieces of ceramic, and these big objects that we call concretions, which are when a metal artifact sits in salt water for a long period of time. It gets covered by calcium carbonate and barnacles, and then it incorporates sand and seashells. And it's basically this chemical process that happens when metals interact with seawater. But what it does is it creates this weird kind of bleh crust on the outside of a metal artifact. And that's the concretion. So a lot of what we find, we don't know what's inside of it until it goes into the conservation lab. So it's really funny. A lot of the artifacts I found, I would be working on it 1 year, and then a whole year later, the conservators would be like, hey, guess what you found inside that concretion? You actually found this really cool part of a wine glass, or you found all these musket balls. So that's kind of the basic process of how we start the excavation. We lay out a grid over the site as well. So we meticulously record everything within one grid square, and then we transfer what we found in that grid square to the larger site plan. And so that way we have efficiently and effectively recorded where over 500,000 artifacts were found.
Wow. Oh my gosh. So when you're going down there and dredging, obviously you're coming up with so much, and it has to be such a meticulous process so that you don't harm anything while you're trying to pull it up. But I am curious, you had talked about how natural elements or fish play a role in what you are pulling up, or they have created their own kind of ecosystem around these shipwrecks. So how do they play a role in covering some of these artifacts, and how can you identify them if they maybe are so camouflaged by this new ecosystem?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is a great question, because I like to joke a lot that half of what I do, especially in underwater archaeology, is trying to determine if what I see is an artifact or just a rock. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem in archaeology in general, because a lot of very early artifacts from the prehistoric period, they were made out of rocks. So a lot of what we're looking at is this just a rock that was formed naturally through normal geological processes? Or is this a rock that has been modified by humans and then is an artifact? But then underwater, that becomes increasingly complicated, because that concretion material that forms that layer on the outside, it makes them appear kind of like big blob-like rocks. And then things like coral and sponges and algae will attach themselves to that concretion. So then that's how it really genuinely becomes an artificial reef underwater, that you get these little bits of coral and all these beautiful soft sponges living there. And then you get tons of other organisms that live in and around it. On the Queen Anne's Revenge site in particular, we have a lot of little black sea bass. We have sheep's head fish. I've even seen leatherback sea turtles and dolphins. And very, very occasionally, we get whales swimming by on their migratory pattern. And the whales I've never seen in person, but you can hear their beautiful droning whale song. You could hear it from very far away, but then a couple times we've definitely heard whales coming pretty close to the site, which was really cool and an incredible experience. The Queen Anne's Revenge area, the area around there off of Beaufort Inlet in North Carolina, is also a sand tiger shark breeding ground. So while I've never actually, only one time did I see a shark on the site, but we know that they're there and they're all around. But due to the really low visibility of the water around there, we often have visibility that's less than a meter. We know that there's sharks are around us, but we can't always see them.
Wow, that's got to get the heart beating a little bit when you feel that there are eyes on you, but you're still doing your job.
Absolutely. I don't know if it's better or worse that the visibility is low, because maybe it's better.
Yeah, right. Then you don't exactly know what's looking at you. So, what are some of the encounters, or how deep have you gone yourself personally down into these areas?
So I'm certified to scuba dive to 50 meters, which is around 165 feet underwater. And I have gone all the way down to shipwrecks that are located at those depths. A lot of the wrecks I work on in the Mediterranean are at those depths. The Queen Anne's Revenge site is actually relatively shallow. It's in only 10 meters or 30 feet of water. And that is great because it means we can excavate for hours and hours during the day. Much deeper sites mean that you're subject to what we call decompression limits in scuba diving. So I'm sure you guys have heard of things like the bends or nitrogen narcosis and things like that. And those are things that happen to you when you go scuba diving quite deep underwater. So nitrogen narcosis is when you start to feel a bit funny. You kind of get a funny feeling where things are a bit fuzzy. And they liken it to taking, two or three shots of tequila in a row. You
Wow.
start to. Yeah, your whole mental faculties, they kind of start to just be a bit slower. Doing things like basic math takes a lot longer than it would on land. And the funny thing about that is we still don't really understand the physiological processes of nitrogen narcosis, because as soon as you go to shallower depths, you totally feel normal again, and then your brain starts working again. Decompression sickness, or the bends, that happens when too much nitrogen gets into your body too quickly, and you basically ascend too fast. And so then the nitrogen is trying to come out of your body before you allowed it time to decompress, as we call it. And so on those sites, we basically get only a tiny window of time to work. So I'll give you an example. I work on one ancient shipwreck in Cyprus in the Mediterranean that dates from around 400 BC. And that wreck is at almost 50 meters. So it's at almost 165 feet. And on that shipwreck, I only get 20 minutes a day to work on it. So I can go down and I can dive for only 20 minutes. And then I have to start coming up, or else I'll get decompression sickness. And that puts a very big kind of pressure on our, there's the physical pressure of the water, but then there's also the pressure on us as archaeologists to work as quickly and efficiently as possible. So on those sites, we have to have such a clear, comprehensive plan of exactly what we're going to do and exactly where we're going to excavate in order to make the most of our time down there.
Yeah, well, how have advances in technology assisted in these excavations?
Oh, advances in technology assist so much. So I can tell you a little bit about some of the tools that I use that I'm really excited about. My company, Barca Archaeology, owns two miniature autonomous underwater vehicles, and these are these super cool, really awesome little robots that they can scan the seafloor for me. And they can go up to 300 meters, which is almost 1,000 feet underwater.
Wow.
And they scan the seafloor using a technique called side scan sonar, which basically sends this acoustic pulse down to the seafloor. And then when the pulse bounces up off of the seafloor, it hits these transducers on the sides of my robots. And then that tells me where objects are on the seafloor. And so these robots allow me to really rapidly scan the seafloor, because these particular little robots, made by a company called Seber, they can scan up to, I think the most we've done is 7 square kilometers, in one day with one of these robots. So with my little fleet of two robots, I can do 14 square kilometers in a day, which is incredible.
That is incredible. And so you're covering so much more ground and pulling so much more data. So why is this data something that will maybe help us in the future or help us understand the past?
The data is really important to gather because shipwrecks all over the world, they're under constant threat. They're under threat from a variety of things. Number one, they could be destroyed accidentally by trawling fishing that drags a net along the seafloor. And these precious ancient shipwrecks, they're really irreplaceable. So it's much better to identify exactly where they are, and then fishermen can avoid them. The other thing that's important about that is that we really want to work with the fishermen to do this, because a lot of times they're very expensive nets that they use to trawl the seafloor. They can get snagged on these ancient shipwrecks or modern historical shipwrecks like the Queen Anne's Revenge. And so that not only damages the shipwreck, but it can also damage the fishermen's nets. So working together to identify where these really important sites are, it could allow us to preserve them, but it also helps fishermen not damage their really important gear so they can continue doing their work and feeding their family. In addition, these things are culturally such important time capsules, because unlike a terrestrial archaeological site on land, which grows layer after accumulated layer from people living there for hundreds, if not thousands of years, a shipwreck represents a moment in time, because everything on board that ship sank and was deposited at the exact same moment, normally during the exact same wrecking event. So we can get a glimpse into life at that moment in time. So in the case of Blackbeard's wreck, we get a glimpse into a moment in time from 1718. And on some of the ancient shipwrecks I work on, it's this whole cargo assemblage that was perfectly assembled, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. So we can learn an incredible amount about the everyday life of these people, as well as what life was like, what agricultural products were like, mechanisms of trade, and even how societies transform by being connected through this maritime trade.
Yes, it tells us so much about these timelines and our past. So when you go back in your mind's eye to some of these dives that you've made, or some of this digging that you've done, even with these new techniques, with this technology, what is the most fascinating thing to you that you have found?
Oh, I have found so many things that I'm really excited about. I think that on some levels, some of my favorite discoveries were actually the scientific discoveries that I've made. Because in addition to doing this diving and being the one who actually scuba dives down and helps dig up the shipwrecks, one of my specialties is archaeological science, which is when I take these artifacts and then we export them back to the laboratories where I work in the United Kingdom. And then I do what we call molecular analysis on them. So that's taking an artifact. So for example, thinking of like a big Roman amphora, a big clay pot that they might have used to transport things in the ancient world. And through the chemical analysis I do of this amphora, I can tell you exactly what was inside of it 2,000 years ago. And so in some instances, we've discovered a completely unexpected thing was inside these pots, which really gave us cause to stop and think that, you know, if everyone sees the shape of this amphora, and because many others contained wine, we just assume that this one did, but then I'll do my chemical analysis and then really clear evidence will emerge that all of these ones did not contain wine, but in fact contained something like olive oil instead. So the molecular analysis of these amphora can really illuminate completely misunderstood aspects of the past. But if I had to think about one artifact in particular that I've ever found, I would have to say that some of the artifacts I found on Blackbeard's ship were just so cool and interesting and kind of had a personal touch to them. So you could think about one of those pirates handling and holding these objects 300 years ago.
Right. I think it allows us to get such a vision of what things were like. And I think it paints such a wonderful picture into our history. I had the opportunity to dive into some shipwrecks that were in Huron. I'm from Michigan, so off in the lakes there, had some opportunities to do some of those dives. I'm not a diver by any stretch of the imagination, and there's no way I could go to the depths that you go. But it is fascinating, and the world of fish that move into these areas really fascinated me. Are some of these areas protected in a way that will protect the coral or protect the animals that have inhabited it?
Yes, a lot of these wrecks and a lot of these areas are protected. Oftentimes, once they've been discovered and then mapped into these nautical charts that all kind of all mariners will use, whether they're fishermen or ferry boats, once they're mapped in, we know to avoid these sites and to not drop an anchor on them. And then in many cases, if people want to go scuba diving on them, they'll be taken by a local dive shop who has a really, a very important kind of, not a technical ownership over it, but more of a feeling of responsibility towards the site where they understand how important it is to protect them. So according to the 2001 UNESCO Convention for the Protection of Underwater Cultural Heritage, a lot of these sites are protected internationally, because that's a consortium of countries who have come together to recognize how important these shipwrecks are and how much they can tell us about the past, how they can foster communities of fish, and how they become artificial reefs, so they should be preserved. So in many, many places, these are perfectly preserved and they're protected and marked as areas that you should only dive with if you're with people who can really help you to make sure you don't damage the wreck, but then also can tell you a lot about the wreck itself after your dive. So I think working with these local communities and getting local communities to foster this sense of collaboration with the historians and the archaeologists who study these wrecks, that's one of the most important things I think that we do as archaeologists, is giving communities, we basically give these shipwrecks back to the communities in which they're found. And then in some cases, they really become a symbol of the town. So where the Queen Anne's Revenge was found in Beaufort, North Carolina, that is certainly pirate country now. And we can see how the excavation of the Queen Anne's Revenge has really given a lot of pride and satisfaction to the community there.
That is so fantastic to hear that there are people that are wanting to preserve this, not only for the good of the ocean and the seas that these are found in, but also for the history. So thank you so much, Dr. Lisa Briggs. Now, you have spoken here in Park City about pirate ships, and we are so grateful to have had you in our community. Where are you heading next? Are you giving more talks, or are you looking forward to another dive that is coming up for you?
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure being here, Claire, and I would love to tell you about what I'm doing next. So on this tour with National Geographic, next we're going to Washington, where I have several shows in Seattle and one in Gig Harbor. And then I'll be going a variety of other places, including Las Vegas, Madison, Wisconsin. And so I'm on this this tour with National Geographic, with our incredible show, National Geographic Live, A Pirate's Life, until November 14th. But then after that, my really exciting projects I would love to tell you about are, I'm the member of a team who is doing a survey of the Tiber River in the center of Rome, because over the last thousands of years, ancient bridges, incredible statues, and so many other fascinating artifacts have been thrown in the river or have just fallen in the river over the last 2,000 years. And so that's another National Geographic project that I'm on with a fellow maritime archaeologist named Dr. Peter Campbell. In addition to that, we're looking forward to doing more underwater archaeological work in the first ever huge survey of the Nile River in Egypt, where we're doing a similar thing as what we're doing to the Tiber, where we're scanning the river bottom for ancient artifacts. So I've got two really big river projects coming up that I'm absolutely delighted to work on.
Well, we can't wait to have you back to talk about those. And we are so grateful that as a young one, you saw Indiana Jones and sought that path, and that you have brought so much to this field. It's Dr. Lisa Briggs, a National Geographic explorer and an underwater archaeologist. And you are working on so many fascinating projects in the future. And we can follow you. Where is there a website?
Absolutely. Yeah. Follow me on social media at Lisa Archaeology. And then my company, Barca Archaeology, also helps to bring people to these archaeological sites. So please check us out at Barca Archaeology if anyone has any interest in diving on ancient archaeological sites around the world.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds like a fascinating thing to do. So thank you so much, Dr. Lisa Briggs. We will hopefully have you back here to talk about all these things that you're up to in the future.
Thank you so much, Claire.
This morning, we speak with biologist and author Karen Lloyd about her newest book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. Lloyd shares a firsthand account of the hunt for life beneath Earth's surface and what scientists are learning about unique types of microbial life and how some of the most extreme locales on the planet are broadening our understanding of what life is and how its earliest forms may have evolved.
That's right. Then in the second part of the show, wildlife photographer Will Burrard Lucas discusses his experiences photographing some of the planet's most elusive and endangered animals in Africa, notably from Ethiopia to the Congo. Environmental awareness and education, that's what this Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
We are really excited to first speak with biologist and author Karen Lloyd. Now, Karen has written a new book called Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. Karen, thank you for joining us here on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. First, we like to start with your background and then we'll get that understanding of what an intraterrestrial is.
Cool. So I did my undergraduate degree in biochemistry at Swarthmore College, and I did my PhD and master's in marine sciences at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And then I did a postdoc in Denmark at Aarhus University, which was kind of cool to give me. It was, I don't know what it was technically in, but I was at the Center for Geomicrobiology. And maybe that's a word people don't know, but that's what I do is geomicrobiology.
Amazing. I like that.
You have a very fascinating background. And this all brought you to penning this new book, and it's titled Intraterrestrials. Now, this is not a word that you stumble into quite often. So can you tell us how you came up with this title and what it means to you?
Well, it's sort of like the reason I chose the word intraterrestrials for the book is that it encompasses a lot of the It carries a lot of weight as a word, because what I'm trying to do in this book is sort of introduce people to a biological world that isn't often talked about. And I find in conversations with people don't know that it exists. And so that really was my motivation for writing the book was, you know, literally walking along the street and looking at somebody on the street and thinking, oh, you poor thing, you don't know the cool things that I know about life on this earth. And I want to share that with you. So this intraterrestrials is about life inside Earth's crust, which is not, you know, it's sort of in hot springs like Yellowstone. That's definitely part of it. And maybe that's a part that people have heard about. But there's so much more than that. I mean, there's tiny cracks and little crevices to hide in. And our crust is basically just completely marbleized with living beings.
And by living beings, are we talking about mostly at the bacterial or even smaller level?
Yeah, so bacteria is a word that sort of is a branch, one of the three branches of the tree of life. There's right. Another one called archaea, which kind of, you can kind of lump them together with bacteria in your head, but they are all tiny single-celled organisms that maybe you could put those into a single category in your mind, but actually when you start studying them, they fan out into much more diverse groups. So for instance, everything in the surface world that we touch and think about on a daily basis either breathes oxygen or makes oxygen through photosynthesis. Like that's it. Mm-hmm. It's really just two processes. But all this life in the subsurface, they can breathe pretty much everything on the periodic table. You know, they can take sulfur, pure sulfur, things that look like minerals and turn it into life.
So when you define these microbes, how do you declare them alive? Like how do you, when you're bringing them in, what's that declaration of life?
Oh, that is often a huge struggle.
Right.
we often have to leave open the possibility that what we're studying is dead on an individual cell basis. But across the entire community, we have a bunch of different ways of knowing that they're alive down there. One is that we can see the slow accumulation of waste products from them. And we can see that they use up food slowly over time. We can see that they have the presence of small biomolecules inside their cells that would have degraded if, you know, these deposits that we find are sometimes tens of thousands of years old or even older, and no RNA, no small fragile biomolecule is going to remain intact for that long. So the fact that they're intact, they're maintaining their bodies, they're producing waste, they're breathing, they're eating, we can see all these things happening.
How do they fit into the larger ecosystem around them? Are they a source of food? Are they helping, like you said, maybe allude to, helping to break down waste products or something like that? What is their role in the ecosystem?
They have a bunch of different roles because, you know, we're talking about a layer of earth that's covering the entire earth, that's underneath the layer that we interact with. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that you couldn't say what the single thing does that life does at the surface of the earth, well, life does a lot of things. You know, we oxygen, we break down carbon, our fungi recycle it. Deeper down, they're doing all the same sorts of things, but doing them just a little bit differently. So they don't have the sun, but they have things that are like plants. They're called chemolithoautotrophs. And so they are producing biomass, they're dying, they're feeding other things. From our perspective, they do a couple of things on an immediate level that really help us out. And one is that they recycle a lot of nutrients. Mm. So a lot of the things that they work with, like nitrogen and phosphorus and iron, are things that we are completely dependent on. Our oceans are dependent on these elements that have sort of been released by the subsurface and come back up and can seed our phytoplankton populations that can like make sure that we continue to have oxygen up at the surface. So they're sort of providing that ecosystem service for everybody up at the surface.
The book describes you venturing into extreme locales to research these biological phenomena and non-oxygen environments, so volcanoes or undersea vents. Where did you go and what did you experience?
Yeah, I'll go pretty much anywhere as long as it's pretty safe. Yeah. Believe it or not, I'm not an adrenaline junkie, but I do like to go to meet these. I really like that word you just used, biological phenomena.
Yeah.
they're so different and weird. It's like, right. What do you call them? I have been in multiple submersibles to a mile deep and half a mile deep in the ocean in both the Pacific and the Atlantic. Well, I guess the Gulf of Mexico. And it's just a privilege to get to do that. It's not something that we have the resources to have a lot of people do. So whenever I get the chance to go to the bottom of the ocean, I take it pretty seriously and try to use my time wisely. And there's volcanoes are also attractive because anything that sort of automatically brings what is deeply buried inside Earth's crust up to the surface is going to be a point of interest for my work. So while there aren't living microbes in lava, that's too hot, it would break down cells. All of the volcanic activity brings up these nutrients that are from the deep earth that can sustain these populations. So then we look at the areas around volcanoes and sometimes in the craters of volcanoes to see who's sort of buried down, nestled down in the deeper reaches that's using all these chemicals.
And when you're studying this, how do you determine the age of these? How do you know how old they are? Because I'm imagining they can be thousands, maybe even a million years old?
Yeah, so that is something that we are actively working on. As far as the age goes, the thing that we can really put a date on is the layer of geological formation that they're sitting in. Mm. That's the thing that we can date. And we can also often know what the history of that has been. So I study some ancient permafrost in Siberia, and we can look at the crystalline structure of this frozen soil and see that it has never been unfrozen for a million years. And so in those cases, we can say, okay, the organisms that we find here have been, either they or their lineage have been sitting here for a million years. Then what do they look like? What, you know, are they alive? Do we find evidence that they are living? Are they intact? And if so, have they changed at all? And as far as we can tell, there's not a lot of change that happens over these million years that things are buried. You know, it's just, we can, it's not just permafrost, it's also deeply buried underneath the oceanic sediments. And there's not, if we look at the total energy that's available to these things and the rate at which it's delivered, it's not enough energy to really sustain a lot of cell divisions. So our assumption has to be that they are as old, that individual cells may be as old as the layer of sediments that they sit in, which could maybe not be true, but to a first approximation, that appears to be true.
Wow. When were these microbes first, I don't know, say, discovered or so? I mean, was Humboldt aware of them? Was Darwin aware of them? Were the scientists back in the, you know, 19th or 18th century aware of microbes?
I would guess not. I mean, microbes, sort of Edward Koch is credited with the first pure culture of microbes in 1885. I think he cultured Bacillus anthracis, which is the normal soil microbe that produces anthrax. Before that, there was Antonie von Leeuwenhoek, who developed the first microscope in like the mid-1600s, I want to say. And so he's credited with being the first person to actually like see these things. I think he called them animalcules. I don't know how to pronounce that word. So for centuries, scientists have known about the existence of microbes. You know, this is something that's really flourished. We know that there's a huge diversity of microbial life on Earth. They do a huge diversity of things. They grow on petri dishes. They grow in your laboratory. Sometimes you wait overnight and they're fully grown, teeming mass of cells, and you can do all kinds of experiments on them. And this gave us enough to chew on for hundreds of years that we never would have known that anything else was out there. You know, there's plenty. There isn't that enough? All the great diversity of bacteria that exist. But then we got a new toy, and the new toy is DNA sequencing directly from the environment. So not sequencing an organism, not like taking a blood sample from something and seeing what its genome looks like after we already see the thing, but rather just like pulling up some muck from the bottom of the ocean or filtering some seawater or, you know, just grabbing some dirt. And that, we can extract the DNA from that. And that's when, I would say in the late 80s, kind of in the late 90s is when this really started becoming democratized and lots of us were doing this. We were like, oh man, we were missing a lot. There's so much more in there.
And so much more, I'm supposing.
Yeah, the thing is that we already had a huge diversity of life that we knew about from growing all these cultures. You know, we, with the larger weave, like the field of microbiology, I certainly don't take credit for that.
Right.
But when those of us who started looking at DNA sequences directly from the environment started doing that, all of the DNA sequences I was pulling out of these hydrothermal vents or methane seeps, I shouldn't say all, the vast majority of them looked nothing like anything anybody had ever grown before. So even with the great diversity of microbial life that we had known about, we were finding even weirder stuff. Phylogenetically speaking. So they were deeper branches on the tree of life, whole new phyla. Like a phylum is a very high level of the taxonomic groupings. It's like all of invertebrates are a phylum, I think. I'm not so good at my animal taxonomy, but it's really a very high level thing. And we were pulling out new phyla like daily.
It's really interesting to me to try to wrap my head around these microbes and these spaces in the earth that we would consider to maybe be very inhospitable for anything that's living. Have you studied them long enough? Are they reacting to climate change? Can you see any changes or differences?
Does that matter to them? Yeah.
And does it, yeah, matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly it will matter in some areas. So one thing that will is definitely going to matter for them is when we actively put things down into the earth, which is not necessarily a bad thing. So there's a lot of climate change mitigation strategies that involve sticking liquidized CO2 back down into spent oil wells or deep saline aquifers to try to lock it up and keep it as a way to sequester that. And so that is absolutely going to affect these populations. And then the big question is, well, how are they going to react to this over the short term? And then over the long term, are they going to help us? Or are they going to just spit it right back out at us and, you know, basically gum up the works and precipitate everything out and make us unable to put any more down there? All that is really a very nascent area of research, and we need to figure a lot more out about it. But certainly, just in terms of like the things that are the natural things that are changing with climate change, it's going to change basically their interface with our surface world. Increased rainfall is going to change the delivery of materials down to the deeper subsurface. Changes in organic matter delivery to surficial sediments in the sea are going to change their ability to work with things like methane. So I think that the deep down ones will be affected when we actively inject things into their world, and the ones at the interface are going to be affected by, you know, all the other things that we are affected by for climate change.
We're speaking with Karen Lloyd. She's a biologist and author of the new book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. So Karen, is it possible that these intraterrestrials might be found in extraterrestrial settings, i.e., you know, Mars, Venus, et cetera? Is there curiosity about that?
Man, I hope they're there. Wouldn't it be great? There's absolutely, I would love it. You know, when I look at the surface, you know, the images that people are taking of Mars or Europa, that's just, you know, we don't see life flourishing at the surface.
Right.
But it could certainly be there because I, you know, in my job, I look at landscapes that are just as desolate looking as Mars or Europa. And I know that they have lots and lots of different, diverse microbial life there. So when I look at Mars and Europa, I don't see certain desolation, especially when you dig back the layers and you're more protected from UV radiation. I think that there's a lot of good places for microbial life to hide. So my assumption would be that a lot of planetary bodies have microbial life. We just need to disprove it.
I said, I don't know if that's a good thing or not, Karen, because if that's discovered, or if there's, you know, better thoughts that there is microbial life like that on Europa or Mars, that means our multi-billionaires will spend even more billions of dollars to go to those places rather than spending their billions of dollars to finish exploring this planet. So that's where I come from there. Because there's so
much more
to explore. Your work is evidence of that.
That's right.
What's the next exploration you're interested in? Where do you want to go next? What's left to be explored about these microbes?
I mean, I think that probably the thing you should take from my book or my work is that it may, when it seems like everything's already known and the textbooks have pretty much got everything sewn up tight, that's not true. There's so much more to be learned. So my next work is in back to the Arctic. We're going to look for some more in permafrost. We're going to look for some more delicate biomolecules to see further evidence of who's actually alive in the places that we've been looking. But I'm always game for anywhere. And there's so much that we haven't explored all over Earth and inside Earth.
Right.
How would you describe the way in which you present the information in this book? For example, for the layperson like myself, if I pick it up, can I grasp it? Am I reading the sentence over and over and looking up the words, 60% of the words? Or
I hope not. I'll tell you, the way I wrote this book is that I wrote it in my most communicative, non-jargony, not for a scientific audience, for a general audience. I would write a whole section as forwardly as I could, and then I would set it aside, and then I would go back and completely rewrite it and take jargon out. So I had to like remove layer upon layer of science speak And I think what I ended up with is something that's really fun. I basically just thought, like, what is the craziest analogy I can think of for the concept that I'm trying to convey? I don't know. I talk about, like, Missy Elliott's Flip It and Reverse It song, which I think is just a fantastic song. And it's a great analogy for DNA sequencing.
I love it. And I asked that question because I do know that you were very intentional about making sure that myself and others that don't work in this can pick this up and understand it and have a grasp of it. And I think it's interesting for us to have this greater understanding of what we're standing on and what's beneath the surface.
Yeah, well, real quick, we got a minute or so. I got a text from a listener who wanted to know about deserts and microbial life in desert settings. Did you visit desert-like settings?
Yeah, so deserts are amazing because you can often turn over a rock or flick a couple of layers off the outside of a rock, mm-hmm. and there will be a green line inside the rock. So the name of the game there is surviving the onslaught of sunlight. And so one way to do it is to hide inside rocks, which I just think is fascinating.
And surviving in the absence of water.
Right. So the water's there. It's just not in high abundance.
Okay.
And so I sort of maybe counterintuitively, the problems that people face in deserts, who study microbial life in deserts or any life in deserts, are similar to what we do in permafrost, because there's plenty of water in permafrost, but it's all crystalline in the form of ice.
So is water then still a common requirement for all of these microbes?
Yep.
Oh.
We have never found something that cannot get by without water. And we have not found something that does not have DNA just yet.
Okay.
These are things that seem to be common for absolutely every inch of life on Earth so
they're
far.
Breathing from the periodic table, but they have to have water. Oh, that's so fascinating.
That's right.
No.
That's right.
Oh, wow. Well, this is such such fantastic work that you're doing. We're glad that you put out this book so that we can all better understand what is happening beneath the surface. So thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth. It's Karen Lloyd, who has just penned the book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. And where can people find you or your work? Do you have a website?
My website is, it's kind of in flux right now, but it's at the University of Southern California. You can find it. But the book is wherever you buy books.
Right.
It's in Amazon, whatever.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks for having me.